I'm delighted that Will has consented with a mild reluctance befitting of his Baptist heritage to speak about where these matters come from for him. I have appreciated very much the times that I've had an opportunity to sit and talk with Will. I know his work here on the campus at Augustana, associated with rural agriculture and the economy. I have a sense of him as a farmer, working through all those demands, doing the dance with nature and markets, and then what it means to the two of you together to actually pull things together every year in light of the dynamic of being on the front line of making it possible for all of us to live. Food, it's a fundamental part of what it means to be a human being. And then also, I've had the pleasure of talking and listening with him around the changing shape of the rural world and the church that he and his family have been a part of, and the community, and making that work. So I'm delighted that you're going to think out loud for us a little bit today, and we'll have a chance to talk together. So I suppose I should also say that you've always struck me as the only one on the Augustana campus who could walk out of a Hollywood film, which would have High Noon in it. So.
With that, I don't.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, David.
Maybe, huh? You might want to sit, well, wherever you're comfortable, but there are some other spaces. Well, there's.
I was wondering if it was my girl. It was my attaché.
Okay. Well, we'll begin. And for a little while this morning, I thought maybe I got off the hook. Nobody seemed to be showing up. But I hope that most people found their way here. Cultivating the fields of meaning as agricultural overtones, I guess. I can't take credit for that totally. I'm sure you can recognize a term like that as something. What's that mean? Speak louder? Oh. Something coming from the lips of David Goa. But anyway, that's what he asked me to speak about. It was. I thought it had a good ring to it. And I'm going to come back to that after a little bit when we come to cultivating. These meetings are about vocation, as I understand it, and I'm representing a farmer. Both Mary and I, I'll just give you a little bit of background into where our history, if you like. Both Mary and I were raised, born and raised on a farm, not the same farm, but we were born and raised as farm kids. After leaving home and earning university degrees, or if we earned them, but we got them anyway, decided some 40 years ago to move to and operate and live on a farm of our own, not in partnership with brothers or anything. It was this independence we were looking for. We wanted to provide an environment for our children. We both shared a love for nature, living things, plants, animals, and the whole creation. And we wanted to be able to develop that in our kids as well. Limited capital was the start. Most farm beginning farmers, Bill nods his head. The desire to be independent required us to work off farm a fair bit. Mary and Moore, as the children started to leave home in the field of nursing, and I worked in various capacities with various community agricultural organizations, still do, and for over 30 years have been a sessional lecturer at what was once CLC and was with it through all the changes up until it's now Augustana with the University of Alberta. Ours has been a varied vocation. So as I reflect on the meaning of vocation, my mind, I wrote here, made a few notes, my mind has drifted a lot over different directions in the last few weeks as I've thought of this. Then I got to thinking my mind drifts a lot anyway now. Probably has more to do with my approaching old age. I don't think it's got here yet. what and still does to me, pardon me, what has and still does appeal to me as about farming? What forms my philosophy? And I'll just list a few things. I've had instilled in me since a child a love for the outdoors and a joy of being part of it. That's number one. Secondly, a belief that this world was created by God and still is His. And we as farmers have the privilege and responsibility to care for a little part of that world and to pass it on, hopefully, in as good or better condition than we found it. I don't think mankind has done a very good job of tending creation. I'm particularly concerned about what I call the thin, someone else has called it that, I'm sure, the thin, fragile outer skin of the Earth's surface, 6 inches to 12 inches, something like that. Unless you're on the real good soil at Tofield, then it's about 2 feet. Around Kingman, it's only 6 inches or less. Such a fragile part, and yet the whole, all of us are so dependent on that little bit. Now, our family has been and is responsible for a very little part of that. Another thing that I think about as to what does appeal to me about rural living and farming is I've had a great interest and involvement in rural communities, including our church as a place of worship. And I like rural people. I also like urban people. But I have...
It's harder to like them.
Sometimes. But I have a special, I think, affinity for that, and I guess that comes with the territory. And finally, and this you might find a little different, I've always been a bit of a risk taker. I've enjoyed challenges. I like taking a risk. I haven't gotten over to the casino yet. I hope to stay away. That might get addictive too. Farming's addiction.
That's riskless. You always lose.
Pardon me?
That's riskless. You always lose.
Oh, I see. Thanks. I won't go there. But as a farmer, we do encounter a tremendous variety of risk. Risk of prices, yields, performance, worldwide economic conditions. We naturally want to be in control, but we aren't. I think that's kind of the bottom line. And on that note, I wanted to read to you just a little reflection by a fellow many of you might know, Reverend Bob Jacobson, now Father Joseph Jacobson, and he wrote this book of reflections, and I'd like to read one to you. I think this will form a start for what I have to say. Jesus said, "Let me tell you something about the kingdom of God. Think of a farmer. He scatters his seeds on the soil. After that, it makes no difference at all if he is asleep or awake. If it's night or day, that seed will spring up and keep on growing. He has no idea how it all works. Without any help from him, the soil produces a crop. First the leafy stage, then the head, then the plump kernel in the head. Then one day, lo and behold, the crop is ready. All he has to do is start swinging his sickle, and he can bring in the harvest. Well, I'm not sure I agree fully with those words, but they're the words of Scripture. But it's Jacobson's translation. But I want to read to you what he says about this. To this day, even with all our modern scientific knowledge, there is a great mystery at the heart of farming. It remains much more the art of learning how to cooperate with larger forces than learning how to control them. Yes, we do our part to set the stage, but when the actual, absolutely vital action is taking place, all we can do is stand by and watch. Watch to see if the seed sprouts. Watch to see if the rains come. Watch to see if the sun shines. Watch to see if the seedlings survive the pests. Watch to see if the heads form. Watch to see if the frost strikes. Watch to see if the kernels fill up. Watch to see if the weather will hold so we can bring in the harvest. There is a lot of lo and behold in farming to this day. I think there's a lot to reflect on in that. So for the next few minutes, I will try to share with you some of the challenges that we have faced. And that's what I hope to do today, is to outline to you some of the sort of dilemmas, mental dilemmas, decisions we have had to make and still are making that are challenges to us, and some of the intrinsic conflicts of values that confront us. And so I particularly look forward to hear more of what you have to say and comment on as you can pick up on some of these things. I won't elaborate a lot on them, but I can later as you ask the questions or as you comment. One of the challenges is to maintain or to encourage a rural community lifestyle in a world that is shrinking very, very quickly. The global community, transportation, communications, the internet, we've become all very, very homogeneous, if you like. It's difficult to, I think, maintain what is intrinsically unique about rural life and about rural occupation. Secondly, a challenge to us has been that we have always valued the things that are involved in a small family farm. Hands-on, children involved, learning the wonder of living things and how things work, and the opportunity to work with them, as in contrast to the large mega farms that are increasingly taking over the landscape. The small farm is becoming a relic of the past, if you like. And to quite a degree, that's what we have tried to cultivate. Should use that word carefully, is the benefits and values of that particular lifestyle. I could elaborate more on that, but I won't right now. Thirdly, and this is a challenge that certainly isn't just confined to the farmer, but I'd like to elaborate a bit on some of the ways it particularly affects us, and that is dealing with rapid change, accelerating change, mechanization, communication, GPS, if you like, And I've said this to some of you maybe before, but I believe very strongly that in the last 20 to 25 years, agriculture has changed more than it did in the previous hundreds of years, literally. My grandfather, my father, all the way up to what I was doing for a while too, was basically the same thing. But now things have changed so very, very dramatically. Farms are very, very much larger. Where was I at here? If you think of alone, just the cell phone, the internet, the GPS. You know, I used to think as I drove through the country that I could sort of tell the good farmers from the sort of average by how straight their seed rows were. You know, some guys would claim, you know, you could shoot a gopher down between those rows and never take off. You know, this was always kind of a point of pride. Now you drive around the country, and even poor farmers got a straight seed row. GPS keeps the tractor right on line. Alan's wiggles around a little bit yet. And one of the things that we have started to do about 15 years ago was to seed directly into the stubble. And that's when I come back to cultivation. I think David, in thinking of cultivating, was back a few years. We don't cultivate much anymore, by and large. And that has been a huge change in agriculture. Zero tillage. Just, I've never hooked on to my cultivator now for a lot of years. Is it good? Is it bad? There's certainly some, and here's where some of the challenges come in. There are certainly some big advantages. I think there's some advantages environmentally with carbon emissions and various things. Reduction in soil erosion due to wind and water. If we had were still farming like we were in the 30s, you wouldn't have been able to see across the street quite a few days this last few years. But the dust does not blow like that anymore, and that's largely because of our tillage practices, or lack of tillage practices. So then there are disadvantages to zero tillage in a lot of the modern ways. We have become so dependent on organic chemicals. I don't know about organic chemicals, but chemicals anyway. Our big enemy has always been, since the time of Adam, I think, our enemy as farmers has been weeds. Or at least that's one of our big enemies. Always having to deal with weeds. And that's why we summer fall. That's why we cultivated a lot. Now we don't have to, because we can just spray something on the weeds and they die. Do you think that makes me comfortable? You know, it doesn't. It makes me uncomfortable. So that's one of the dilemmas that we face. And finally, I'll just bring this one up. Maybe a couple more. The conflict between science, the scientific world, and the growing fear of many, many people that the scientists are wrong and that we are possibly doing great harm to the world in the way we live, in the way we farm, in the way we do our business, such things as chemicals, growth hormones. Science and technology, I think, has enabled the world to vastly increase the output of food. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I don't know. I could postulate that I would think if it hadn't been for those kinds of things, we would have far, far more people in the world starving today than we do now. There are fears of the harm on environment, of our own health, and so I'll give my own personal dilemma here. I was raised, as most of you were, as a scientist. You know, I've been taught to believe in science and good research and good measuring sticks. And to, and when you stop and think about it, not just the farmers, the whole world is enjoying, vastly enjoying, the benefits of what these people have done for us, the inventors, the we have a lot of concern about some of the negative effects of our farming practices on the environment. And then I look at those jet planes flying across the sky, and as far as I can understand, there's far more harmful emissions and problems. Why don't we have more talk about that? It's because everybody travels on it. My suggestion would be to raise the price of airline tickets by at least 100% and using the extra money to start to mitigate some of the damage that aircraft have. Why can't we do that? Because you wouldn't pay it, would you? I don't know. Maybe it'll come to you. Okay, I'll leave that one because it opens up a whole raft of areas of discussion. Finally, personally, we have one of the real challenges to us has been to rationalize between the conflicting goals that we have. For example, profit maximization. Is that a legitimate goal in itself? Well, I've had to pay enough bills and pay off mortgages enough to know that if you aren't a profit maximizer, or at least loss minimizer, I sometimes tell my students that, you know, when you talk about profit maximization, it's not, sometimes it's loss minimization, and that's really the same thing. But you have to be conscious of that, and we have to run our businesses efficiently if we are to survive. Balancing that against our concerns for our impact on the world, meaningful lifestyles that we want to have for our children and ourselves, the ability to contribute to our families, to our communities, and to the suffering and needy of the world, all around the world, as well as in our own communities, and to identify with them. Those are challenging dilemmas that we face, not much different, I don't think, than our urban cousins, but still it's been a real challenge for us. We have had to resist the temptation to get big. Now, I don't know if we've had to, but we have resisted. And we've been left behind in many ways. And I don't know if the size of farm we're now operating, it will survive very long in its present way of doing things. I could name you a dozen people within 30 miles, or probably more than a dozen people farming 8,000 and 10,000 acres. And I just know that they don't know their individual fields and ravines and shapes and so on like I know mine. That's not a criticism. It's just, and they don't have to. It's all GPS for them. They just go. I would reflect talking to one of them, one you may have known for a while. Saw him in town one day after. I said, "You all done harvest?" "You know, Wilfie," said, "I thought I was. I forgot all about that one quarter over there east." And I thought, you know, what a commentary, really, on the way we farm. We love to farm, and we think of farmers doing. It's quite a difference. Anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. And I know we've got to get Bill out of here by 10, and I hope you people are a lot more long-winded than I am. Do you have questions? Comments of your own? This has been our experience very, very quickly. We think a lot about it.
I'd just like to ask Bill, on that point of farms growing bigger, of course rural communities growing smaller. Mm-hmm. my grandparents' day, and of course there were a lot of people that farmed the border or maybe the half section of land. And there were, of course, rural schools all over the place, rural villages. And then as farms grew bigger and roads got better, the very small places suffered. Do you see this trend continuing? Or are we at a kind of equilibrium? Excuse me now. In other words, the people that are really wanting to be out of farming have probably left by now. Or is it one of those trends that is likely going to continue, and so that there's really not much future for the very small, for the small communities?
Well, I'll take a first crack at that, and I'm sure there's lots of other. I don't see the trend stopping as far as the size of farms. I'm not saying all farms are going to disappear, the smaller ones, but certainly I don't see really anything to stop the growth in the size of farms. Economies of scale are such that it works. Feedlots, we used to have all kinds of people in the Kingman and Tolfield and Caramels area that fattened maybe 75 or 80 steers in the winter. I know when we first started, we were feeding 100 steers, and first couple of years, it was about $100 a head profit. And at that time, $10,000 was a fair bit of money. The profit per head now on fattening a steer is probably around $10 to $15. And so how many am I going to have to do to feed my kids? You know, and the point is, I can't ask my $100. That's the realities of free enterprise. And the prices are set in the market, and if they can be produced for that, that's what you have. That's why you get beef so cheap. You know, those T-bone steaks are really cheap, you know, you guys. Bet you didn't know that. Anyway, but I still think that there is a future for more like a niche type of, you know, small family farms that if they're lucky enough that they're paid for, don't have a mortgage, very low living costs. But the cost of living out there at Kingman are just as high as they are here in Camrose. It's not, they're escalating. Off-farm work is probably going to be the solution for the smaller, real, you might say, half section, quarter section. I think a quarter section or a half section makes more sense than what we do with 7 or 8. I think it almost makes more sense. Because you're still going to have to work off. It doesn't take as long to handle a quarter section, is it? Now, anybody other questions that come?
The situation in Europe is so different, isn't it?
I mean, in
Europe,
it likely is.
You have small farms.
That's interesting.
Now, there are climate issues which need to be taken into account and layered into this. But you use that key word, free market, which is hardly free. It's on your back. In Europe, I mean, I don't know much about this, but it seems really obvious to me that one of the big differences is the place of food in the European economies and the commitment of nations to local production. Now, I know there are jiggles around this with the European Union, but we are entering into a new relationship with Europe, presumably, according to our Prime Minister. And the arguments are that this means a freer flow of capital. But I also wonder if there's not going to be a slingshot effect here. So I just want to raise you know, maybe not in my lifetime or yours, but this isn't, you know, the way in which this is unfolded is not written in stone. There isn't some absolute around this. There are decisions that have been made and that we make and that each of us makes every time we buy that cheap steak. So if you look at the European situation with where governments have been much more concerned with local production and the safety of the community. And here, you and I have talked about this before, but where whether it's the NDP or the Reform Party, they largely could give a damn about the rural world. But that's gonna, that I think that will eventually turn around a little bit. What do you think?
I don't think it will turn much in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But I would hope. You know, I don't.